Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in today's show.
On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 211. The motion is adopted. Objection, a motion.
The House passes the $1.9 trillion COVID bill, but it wasn't without debate. What did your California representatives have to say about it? We have some House floor audio for you. And we have today's news brief, but we start off today with the freedom of information when it comes to environmental policy. President Joe Biden, on his first day in office, issued several executive orders that will have an effect on environmental policy and agriculture. Among his orders was that within a deadline of 30 days, several agencies issue reports on their recommendations for changes to current policies. That 30-day period has come and gone, and if those reports were submitted as they were supposed to be, there's no public sign of them. The Pacific Legal Foundation has taken notice of that, and joining me on the phone is Senior Attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, Tony Francois.
But let's start off with just a little bit of, I like to have a lot of transparency, especially in these kinds of things. So if you would tell us, what is the Pacific Legal Foundation?
Sure. Pacific Legal Foundation is a nonprofit, donor-supported, public interest law firm that represents landowners and business owners across the country pro bono, meaning they don't have to, we don't have to charge them anything, in various types of disputes with the government involving their constitutional and civil rights. Most of my work involves private property rights, so the right to be compensated when the government takes your property, your right to exclude the government from your property when they don't have a proper warrant, and things like this.
I read what you wrote, and it was published in The Hill, about President Biden's environmental agenda. We all know that he has a large environmental agenda, and it will have effects on our primary listeners who are in the agricultural industries. And I read his executive order. In fact, I was reading through it again just before the call today. And it has in there that there are deadlines of 30 days from when that was executive order was made, which, of course, was his first day in office. 30 days has come and gone. There's not a lot of public information. That is what you wrote about in your piece that was published. What have you found, and is that still true today? I'm still not seeing anything, but have you found anything else that has been published for the public to read about any findings that happened in those first 30 days?
No. In fact, we've submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to the EPA simply for the list that they sent to the White House on the 30-day deadline, which was already February 19th. So, I mean, we're now a number of weeks past that. And EPA's only response to the Freedom of Information Act request so far is a statement back that this is a complicated request and we're going to need additional time under the law in order to provide a response to it. Now, it's not a complicated request because they don't know what document I'm asking for or where to find it. So obviously there's some, political and perhaps legal reason why they're going to try to stall in providing that list. But it actually came as quite a surprise to me that they're not actually out trumpeting this list, because as you mentioned in that executive order, it basically gives two baskets of work that the regulatory agencies are going to do. The first one, the top priority things being what's on this list that was transmitted to the White House on February 19th, and those are things that the agencies, EPA, Department of Agriculture, that's going to include the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the Forest Service, et cetera, that they think that they can reasonably get completed changes to the prior administration's regulatory programs by the end of this calendar year. And then there's a second list that's due now in about a month and a half that would be other things that would take longer to do or would be lower priority, but that the agencies still think that they can get accomplished sometime before the end of President Biden's term. So these regulations that are on the list that were sent to the White House on February 19th, these are really kind of the big ticket items, the things that they want to get done right away, the things that they think are urgent, the things that they can, that think are simplest to reverse some of those Trump era regulatory reforms. And given the fanfare that went with the executive order that you mentioned, you'd think that they would then be saying, okay, here's we've looked at everything, here's the most important things we're going to get done right away. And instead, A, they've not released that to the public, and B, hardly anybody seems bothered by that. And both of those just seem counterintuitive to me.
Right. And like I said, it's a difficult topic, and I'm not a particularly political person, but I believe very strongly in the freedom of information and that the public should know what is going on in politics. And it sounds like that is at the root of this issue. It's not the fact that it's President Biden versus President Trump. It's that we don't know what's happening and we're unable to find out. Am I correct in that?
Well, I think you are. And one of the points I made in the column that you mentioned in The Hill is that part of what this is showing is that whether it's President Trump or President Biden, there's a common thread to it, which is that most of the work that the agencies do is controlled, and a lot of the decisions made by non-elected and non-accountable, not appointed leaders of those agencies. It's largely done by the career civil service staff of those agencies. And one of the things I think this does reflect is a kind of a long-term view on their part that presidents and parties come and go in the White House, but we actually set the agenda here, and we'll be here. We're here before you came. We'll be here when you're gone. And for the most part, we'll decide how things work. I think it's reasonable to describe the Trump administration as, in one way of looking at it, as kind of a nonstop struggle with this reality. And the Biden administration so far, actually kind of collaboration in that. For better or worse, I think the dynamic you see is that some administrations tend to simply let the career civil service, take the lead, and others will fight it a little bit, but have difficulty making headway against it. So I think it's possible, for example, that one of the reasons these lists are being held under wraps is that the cabinet secretaries who will run these agencies have not yet been confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And so, it becomes then a little bit more difficult. There's more hard questions to be answered if these lists are made public and those nominees then have to answer questions. Okay, so this program is on the list. What's your plan for that? What do you intend to do? And so keeping the lists secret, maybe that smooths the way for their confirmation somewhat. But there's another aspect of it that I just find very odd. It's a sports analogy, but if you think of, like a football team firing its head coach and its coaching staff, and then what you see sometimes is before they hire a head coach, they'll hire a coordinator, like an offensive coordinator. And then they'll hire a head coach and say, you're going to be stuck with this offensive coordinator. You've got to go with what they've installed, so you're going to have to be fine with that. The way that applies here is that these lists, supposedly the nominees to run these agencies, not having been confirmed yet, are not yet telling the agency staff what to do. so these lists have been populated. You know, the decisions have been made to recommend that the agencies, you know, do the following without the benefit, at least officially, of the people that the President of the United States has nominated to lead the agencies. And so it raises a question, who actually is setting the priorities for the current administration? Is it the White House led by the President and Vice President that the nation elected? Is it the cabinet secretaries that the elected president is appointing to set the agenda for these agencies? Or is it the permanent bureaucracy simply deciding what they would like to work on and what their priorities are? And they may be wise or foolish in what their priorities are, but ultimately the responsibility to decide on that agenda rests with the White House and with the appointed and Senate-confirmed cabinet secretaries that are supposed to run those agencies.
And these are questions with a lot of weight behind them, because we're talking about policies that largely affect how Americans run their businesses in many ways.
We are talking with Tony Francois. This is an important conversation, and we will continue it right after this.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
Welcome back. We are talking with Senior Attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, Tony Francois, about environmental policy recommendations that have not yet been released to the public and why that's important.
What are some of the types of things that would be on the list that we're talking about?
Well, one of the questions that we've been pressing for an answer to at Pacific Legal Foundation, because we've done a lot of legal work related to this, is whether the agency, whether the Environmental Protection Agency, is going to be revising the Trump administration's definition of navigable waters, or waters right. of the United States, under the Clean Water Act. This has been a subject of significant controversy and much attention paid to it by the nation's farmers and ranchers, because of the implications it's got for whether they can actually use their property or whether there's parts of it they have to, essentially leave idle because, the EPA and the U.S. Army claim control of it. That's something that, a lot of organizations have been litigating over. And so I would think that, for example, the administration would let everybody know that this is something we're planning on addressing in the first year or not. In other words, if this list is made publicly available, then first of all, people will know what's on it and whether the Navigable Waters Protection Rule from last year is slated to be reviewed and possibly either revised or even rescinded this year. If it's not on that list, then you know more about, sort of how durable that rule is, how quickly or slowly the effort will be undertaken to essentially revise it. So it matters whether it's on the list or not, for what your plans are for the coming year, whether to, try to, for example, get a particular property sort of delineated under the current rule, or whether that's going to expire so quickly that it's not worth the effort. I mean, these are pretty practical questions. And so it frustrates people's ability to know what the rules are and sort of how long the rules are going to be in effect, by keeping secret whether that rule is on the list or not. And, you know, a related problem is that right now, in a lot of the lawsuits, both challenging and defending that definition of the EPA's authority under the Clean Water Act, right now the Justice Department is telling courts all over the country, hey, we need to stall out all these lawsuits. We shouldn't be moving forward in them because the president has ordered the agencies to reconsider these rules. But then they're not coming clean with whether or not this particular rule is something that the agencies plan on doing anything about, you know, in the next 10 months. So, you know, there's a, you know, there's mixed messages coming out. Well, this might be reconsidered, but on the other hand, we're not going to tell you whether we're actually reconsidering it or not.
So you, of course, being an attorney, have taken some steps to get this information released to your organization at least. But what can the public do to get this information?
Well, I think there's two important things. One is that, and again, I mean, so Pacific Legal Foundation is not a political or partisan organization. Just take this as sort of general political science, right? That if people are concerned about what's on these lists and the fact that they haven't been made public and that, you know, they're being required to remain uninformed about them, even though, you know, they own the land and the businesses that are going to be regulated by them. Well, the United States Senate continues to deliberate on many of these nominees, and, you know, people should, among other things, consider contacting their senators and ask them, hey, have you asked about these lists? I mean, have the nominees given you any information about what's on the lists? Have the nominees been asked, will you commit to making these lists public so we can ask you about them before we vote on your confirmation? So I think in the political process of confirming the nominees to run these agencies, there are things that can and probably should be done just in the interest of transparency. And I do think that that's a bipartisan good practice. I mean, if you're being confirmed to run an agency, it's certainly not just fair, but I think, you know, the responsible thing to do to press that nominee for what they plan on doing with the agency. The other thing is that, publications should, you know, the people rely on for news about these kinds of things could be asked, hey, when are you guys going to ask, you know, in the White House press briefing or, you know, at an agency press briefing, when these things are going to be released to the public? Why are they still, you know, technically speaking, government secrets? And, you know, that's an important, that's perhaps the critical way that, you know, a free self-governing people stays that way, which is a free press and the accountability that the free press imposes on the government. I had expected when the list wasn't on the EPA's website on February 19th that by early the following week, you know, there'd just be news stories saying, you know, we got a leaked copy of the list, here's what's in it. And instead, there's no stories about this in the major media. Nobody seems to be asking questions about it. There's one, you know, like specialty media publication that reported that, the environmental organizations who submitted their preferred programs for immediate review are fine not being told what's on the list. And that seems like a backwards way of this whole thing being looked at. So I think that those are the two things that the people's representatives in the Senate can and should want to know what's on these lists as part of the confirmation processes. And to the extent that people, you know, have any sort of market power in with their news organizations that they rely on, they should be asking for answers to these questions there too.
All right. We have covered a bit of ground here. Is there anything that you've, any key points that you think we have left out or anything else we should be discussing?
Well, you know, I say all this as a separate matter, really, from, you know, the merits, pro or con, of any of the regulations that the last administration adopted or what the current administration might do with them. You know, that will all happen to the extent that these are, you know, formal regulations that, that may be changed through notice and comment rulemaking that'll give the public an opportunity to comment on proposed changes. But those will only come up as the agencies have more or less finished their work and are prepared to let the public know, here's what we intend to do for this particular thing. This is really about what's the overall agenda. What's the plan? What are President Biden's priorities when it comes to regulating all of the, you know, the natural resource base industries that that are so important to the country?
All right. And then once all that does come out, we know how it's going to start affecting people. Can I call you back?
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to.
Perfect. Thank you again so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Senior Attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, Tony Francois. When we come back, we have today's news brief. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. Here's your news brief for today. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is postponing the Conservation Reserve Program grassland signup that was originally planned to start mid-March. USDA's Farm Service Agency will announce new signup dates in the coming weeks, as the administration is currently evaluating the program and ways to increase enrollment. CRP Grasslands helps producers and landowners protect grasslands while enabling grazing activities to continue. Lands enrolled support grazing operations and promote plant and animal biodiversity. Lands are also protected from being developed. Timing of some of the activities, such as haying or mowing, may be restricted by the primary nesting seasons of birds. More information on CRP can be found online at fsa.usda.gov/CRP. News from the California Farm Bureau. With a House vote expected later this month on an agricultural immigration bill, farm groups have renewed their support for the measure. The Farm Workforce Modernization Act intends to improve the agricultural visa programs and accommodate immigrant farm employees already in the United States. It passed the House of Representatives in 2019, and sponsors have now reintroduced it. The California Farm Bureau calls the bill a top priority, and other farm groups have also endorsed it. When it comes to carrying out African swine fever emergency response plans, an expert says practice is key. Gary Crawford has more.
We have so far been able to keep livestock diseases like African swine fever out of the U.S.
But the threat is certainly there as long as the viruses are out there.
So it behooves everybody in the livestock sector to do their part in prevention, but also in preparing for a possible outbreak. This from Agriculture Department veterinarian Dr. Barbara Porter Spalding.
Or Dr. Barb.
Dr. Barb, I can call you Dr. Barb?
Yeah, people at work call me almost anything.
Okay, we'll use Dr. Barb from here on in, but back to the serious business of preparing for possible outbreaks of foreign livestock diseases.
Practicing response to those diseases, I think that's really critical, and that's what our group within Preparedness and Incident Coordination does.
Yes, they have planning workshops, tabletop exercises, and actual functional exercises to make plans and test them out in order to handle a whole list of things.
Diagnostics, surveillance, quarantine, cleaning and disinfection.
But no time to list them all, but there are 23 critical activities
that have to be done during an outbreak to be successful.
Most recently, Dr. Barb's group's been working on response plans on what needs to happen if African swine fever shows up in this country, and with a particular goal of including more emphasis on action plans for hog slaughter plants. People there need to know the symptoms of ASF and who to call if they see those symptoms. If confirmed, the plant might likely have to shut down. What procedures would need to be followed to do that? And also, what about
cleaning and disinfection of spaces where possibly infected animals have been?
Not to mention procedures set up for possible destruction of any animals in or around the plant and disposal of carcasses. So, Dr. Barb says back in January, they held a general workshop on ASF response plans. This coming May, they will have a more detailed session for hog slaughter plants, including not just emergency response actions, but also
figuring out better ways to help the industry recover.
Recover economically, because once ASF is found in the U.S., Dr. Barb says most likely
all of our international trade in these products will be cut off, at least for a time.
So the 30% of U.S. pork output normally exported could suddenly end up on the U.S. market, causing hog and pork prices to plummet, somewhat like the COVID situation last spring when the food service market suddenly shut down. But Dr. Barb says she thinks that experience at least did enhance
the ability for the industry to pivot
and change direction, which it might have to do if African swine fever does show up in the U.S. But at least there are plans in place for that. Dr. Barb says, though, the key will not be just to have those plans, but to run exercises with them.
Practice, practice, practice.
And that's what they'll do. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Demand for California-grown citrus fruit may rise because of crop losses in Texas caused by its mid-February freeze. This again from the California Farm Bureau. Farmers in Texas lost much of their grapefruit and Valencia orange crops. California farms may produce more of both this season, according to a new estimate. Government forecasters also expect more tangerine production in California, but say crops of lemons and navel oranges could be smaller. We will be talking with a representative of Texas Citrus in next Tuesday's My Ag Life in Citrus. As drought in the Southwest and Southern Plains intensifies and expands, so do concerns related to impacts on agriculture and water supplies going into the year. Rod Bain reports.
The impacts of expanding drought in the Southwest quadrant of the country continues to grow as well. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says the March U.S. Drought Monitor reflects its highest overall total since 2013, much of that originating from the Southwest and Southern Plains. And he adds,
as we head into the spring and summer months in 2021, because we do have concerns that with the presence of La Nina, we'll continue to see a dry spring across much of the Southwest and the Southern Great Plains. And that could lead to further drought development or expansion and intensification in coming months.
Beyond that is growing concerns about crops and livestock in drought conditions. For instance, winter wheat grown in the southern plains.
Currently seeing almost one-third of the winter wheat production area in drought. That has been hovering right in the lower 30s all through February. And it does show that there is a portion of the wheat crop, particularly across the high plains, that is experiencing some drought stress. That also a concern as the crop will be breaking dormancy from south to north over the next few weeks.
Meanwhile, a below-average mountain snowpack season in the southern two-thirds of the West is further exacerbating water supply concerns going into the spring and summer irrigation season.
Part of the problem here is that we finished up last winter with a very dry stretch. We also saw a nearly failed monsoon during the summer of 2020, and then we have gone through another dry winter. We are facing significant water supply concerns all the way from the Sierra Nevada to the Southern Rockies.
Particularly with those past conditions causing below normal reservoir storage levels in much of the Southwest quadrant,
including California and then eastward into Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. Utah stands out a little bit, as in reservoir storage is still near normal, but runoff is not going to be good there. So we do have deep concerns for lack of summer water supply all throughout the southwestern states, again, stretching across California, Nevada, and then Utah, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, all facing the potential of cutbacks on water deliveries and water supply shortages.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
As we're hitting the one-year mark since the COVID-19 pandemic began, many in the industry question where produce stands and how it was impacted over the last year. The Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at University of Arizona has gathered data that shows how the COVID-19 pandemic affected the fresh tomato industry. One of the primary findings shows that after the March 2020 lockdown, When purchasing patterns bounced back, there was a clear preference for the vine-ripened tomatoes. The research project provides insight to changes in the fresh tomato marketing, including shipment volumes, shipping point prices, and retail prices. Additionally, the project also includes how supply and demand trends were affected during the year of 2020, during the peak of the pandemic shutdowns when the food service industry was heavily affected. That's our news brief for today. Coming up, hear what California's elected representatives had to say before voting on the COVID relief bill. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
The U.S. House of Representatives had a heated debate before the vote on the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. Several California representatives took to the podium to voice their opinions. Here is Representative Carbajal, a Democrat from District 24 in the Central Coast area.
A once-in-a-lifetime pandemic requires bold investment, and that is what the American Rescue Plan is. This bill invests $20 billion to get shots in arms and make sure everyone knows where, when, and how to get a vaccine. Many students are back in school or going back soon. California will get $15 billion to reopen safely and keep schools open to make up for lost time. We've also invested in the backbone of our economy, small businesses. In fact, economists believe this bill can bring us back to near full employment in about a year. To ensure local governments can keep providing essential services, this bill delivers over $259 million to cities and counties in my district alone. Finally, this package invests in the American people. Direct payments, unemployment benefits, tax credits, and healthcare subsidies will help lift 12 million people out of poverty. I look forward to voting for this bill. I yield back.
Here is Representative Chu, a Democrat from District 27 in the West San Gabriel Valley.
Every day, constituents in my district are asking when the $1,400 survival checks are coming and when they can get help with their rent so that they don't become homeless. They are suffering and they need help now. The American Rescue Plan is a real plan to crush the virus by speeding vaccine distribution and increasing access to healthcare. This will not only mean safer families, but also safer classrooms for teachers and students. It means a continuation of $300 a week checks in unemployment insurance, and it supports our businesses so they don't close. With over 500,000 dead, we need a way to end this crisis and help our people. That is exactly what today's bill will do. I strongly urge a yes vote.
Minority Leader Republican Kevin McCarthy had lengthier comments. He spoke for more than 25 minutes against the aid bill. Here's a short portion of what he had to say.
I know the Democrats in the House are excited because all their work has even transpired all the way to Nevada because now the socialist Democratic wing of the party has taken over there as well. From H.R. 1 to voting to defund the police, House Democrats have abandoned any pretense of unity. They passed three major bills in 1 month with zero bipartisan support. Today, they plan to pass another. Like the others, it represents a missed opportunity for Congress to focus on the real needs of the American people. At $1.9 trillion in new spending, the so-called American Rescue Plan is the most expensive single bill in American history. Let's put that number in context, Mr. Speaker. If you put it in today's numbers, World War II cost our government $4.8 trillion. But if we pass this bill, our country's total relief, COVID relief spending, will now total $5.5 trillion. The so-called relief bill will end up costing every hardworking taxpayer in America more than $5,000 each. You send the government your tax dollars, but you only get a fraction of what you pay for at the very best. You know, we warned people on the internet about email scams. It's like the ones of those emails where you get a promise you'll get millions of dollars, but first you have to wire them some money. That's exactly what's happening here today. This is the reality of this bill before us. It showers money on special interests, but spends less than 9% on actually defeating the virus. But it gives San Francisco $600 million, essentially wiping out 92% of their budget deficit. Think about that. 9% on the virus, but Mr. Speaker, San Francisco, the home to our speaker, gets to wipe out 92% of their budget deficit. Where does that money come from? Well, every American is now going to pay more than $5,000 so we can send it to San Francisco and give them 92% of their budget deficit. Interesting how socialism works. In both the House and Senate, the only bipartisan vote has been against this. And after five relief bills, it is on track to be the first passed by strictly party lines. Mr. Speaker, I've heard people across the country say this bill today is costly, corrupt, and liberal. Now, even the Biden White House agrees. It is very liberal. They called this the most progressive piece of legislation in history. For those who are watching, progressive means socialism. The same party that runs here and now, the Democratic Party of Nevada, is the Socialist Democratic Party. So let's be clear. This isn't a rescue bill. It isn't a relief bill. It's a laundry list of left-wing priorities that predate the pandemic and do not meet the needs of the American families. No wonder even House Democrats have said they are embarrassed by what is in it. And just this week, one of their own members said there is no question there's some waste in there. But they'll still vote for it anyways. In fact, if you are a member of the swamp, you do pretty well under this bill. But for the American people, it means serious problems immediately on the horizon. Consider this. Mr. Speaker, every person, and it'll only be Democrats who vote for this, will cause a $36 billion cuts in Medicare starting this year. So what they choose to do is cut Medicare to those who need it and send $600 million to San Francisco to pay for 92% of their budget deficit. Or consider K through 12 education. Democrats say they need $130 billion to reopen schools. But their bill only allocates $6 billion to help schools this fiscal year. Two-thirds of the total funding for education won't even be spent until 2023 or later. But don't worry, San Francisco will get their money now. The schools need to wait. You have priorities. Do Democrats expect schools to reopen 2 years from now? I guess that's what they're saying with this bill. They have no plan to get children back in the classroom full time. This week marks the one-year anniversary of school districts across the country switching to school behind a screen. We still don't know the full effects of this decision, but we do know keeping classrooms closed has created an education and mental health problem for students and parents. It has been a lost year for our children's education. And even more devastating, 1 in 4 young adults have struggled with suicidal thoughts. Experience and scientific evidence say reopen schools now. It's necessary and it's safe. Mr. Speaker, the last time this bill was on the floor, we offered an amendment to take that money for that subway just outside of San Francisco and put that money for the children's mental health and others. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, all the Democrats said no, that subway by San Francisco was more important. But fortunately, we were able to remove that from the bill in the Senate. But luckily here, all the Democrats were able to think the priority is not children, it was San Francisco.
House Speaker Democrat Nancy Pelosi spoke at length in favor of the bill. Here's a portion of her comments.
This legislation, which has bipartisan support throughout the country. The Biden, and let me, he praises on President Biden for the values, for the vision, the strategic thinking, for the knowledge that he has brought to what, as you said earlier, we had in the works for a while, but in freshened up by current events, the vaccine, and what those possibilities are. The Biden American Rescue Plan is about the children, their health, their education, the economic security of their families again. Our children's health is greatly protected by crushing the virus and by expanding access to health care through the Affordable Care Act expansions in here, Medicaid through FMAP, and in other ways as well. Our children's education is advanced with a $170 billion to open schools safely, including $130 billion for K through 12. This funding will help address the social and emotional challenges that children face, as well as learning loss, as well as opening the school safely. We know what that requires. It requires ventilation, space, more teachers, more space, to name a few things. In terms of the economic security of children's families, this legislation, as I said earlier, Mr. Neal, puts nearly $1 trillion in the pockets of the American people. The Republicans did not seem to object when they put that much money in the pockets of 83% of their tax scam into the top 1%. But they seem to have a discomfort level when it reaches the poorest of the poor or those in the middle class who are struggling. So this legislation does that. It includes the refundable tax credit, which will lift 50% of children out of poverty. How do you say no to lifting 50% of impoverished children in America out of poverty? Children also benefit from the earned income tax credit, direct payments, and enhanced unemployment insurance benefits for their families. And the economic security of children is also enhanced by pension security of their grandparents, which is historically secured in this bill. Sometimes when I have young people come to my office and ask them, it's all about the children, it's all about the future, high school students, college students, they talk about the security of their grandparents as important because to the extent that their parents can focus on them rather than worry about the financial security of their grandparents, it's very important to the family across the board. For the children, the American Rescue Plan also includes $12 billion in nutrition assistance to help the estimated 11 million children still going hungry. When I talk about this with my family, I say to my kids, you know, there are millions of children food insecure in our country. That's horrible. They'll say, Mom, just say it another way. They're hungry. They're hungry. Some only get their food at school. They go to sleep hungry. If you call that food insecurity, okay, but understand this. These little children are hungry, $12 billion. $43 billion in rental, homeowner, and other housing assistance so that children of families who are on the verge of eviction can have the comfort of knowing that won't happen. They'll have the comfort of home. $45 billion of childcare to keep children learning and parents earning. That is always necessary, but even more so with the 2.3 million women losing their jobs, many of them moms. Now, everything that I mentioned here is related to the coronavirus. We have hunger issues in our country.
bigger than even this. We have housing issues, we have child care issues, and the rest, very important in our country, and it require more than this. But this is coronavirus centric. Child care, I'll say it again, $45 billion, most of it for child care, a little bit of it for Head Start, parents, children learning, parents earning. This is important and central to how families get through this crisis, coronavirus crisis. All of these provisions in the bill are enhanced by strengthening the support for our heroes at the state and local level. Hence, our bill was called the Heroes Act. Much of that is contained in this legislation. Heroes, because our workers at the state, county, and local level, our healthcare workers, our first responders, police and fire, our sanitation, transportation, our food workers, our teachers, make our lives possible and make the existence of our children better. Because many of these jobs are jobs that are needed. Whatever we spend on education in this bill is a small percentage of what state and local government spends on education. More than 90% of it comes from the state and local. So in this legislation, we are ensuring that state and local government keep them in their jobs, these heroes that we talked about, and will help fight the fiscal pressure that they have because of the cost of addressing the coronavirus crisis, as well as revenue lost because of shutdowns and the rest.
In the end, the House voted 220 to 211 to pass the bill. When you think of a farmer with a great story, who comes to mind first? The My Ag Life Daily News Report wants to honor California's farmers for the things they do on and off the farm. Nominate your favorite to be our Farmer of the Week. Farmers who are selected will be contacted for an interview and featured in an upcoming edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. To nominate someone, you can send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. Be sure to provide contact information so we can reach them. Also, tell us why you're nominating them and give me contact information for you as well. All of this information is private and will not be used for anything other than contacting the Farmer of the Week. Again, if you'd like to nominate somebody or if you'd like to nominate yourself, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. That's our show for today from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.